You're listening to Ian Stone's Comedy Breakfast, the podcast edition. I'm here on Love Sport Radio every weekday morning at 6:30. I'm here with the former Brentford and Barnet manager, Martin Allen. Good morning, Martin.
Good morning, Stoney.
Morning, mate. How are you?
I'm very well. Lovely to be back with you.
It's nice to have you back, man. There's been, Andy Murray is back. Did you have a nice holiday, by the way? You went away, didn't you?
I had a wonderful time, but I had one scary moment, Stoney.
What happened?
Well, I was playing golf in a place called Scottsdale in Arizona.
Yes, I've
heard
of it.
Which is a desert golf course.
Yeah.
And after a third round I'd played...
Well, with a desert golf course, are the bunkers got grass in them?
No.
No.
No, but they're big bunkers. They're long bunkers and there's a lot of cactuses, a lot of rocks. And one afternoon, Stoney, about 5:30, I was up there playing on my own. The sun was going down. It's boiling hot. And I looked across to my right as I'm going along in my buggy. And I saw what I thought was a snake.
Right.
And it was a snake. But then I sat there.
You were
there
right
thought,
to think that.
I thought, it's dead. So, no problem. I just went back another 10 yards to look for my ball because I couldn't quite find it because it was on the right rough, you know, of the rough. And when I came back past, this rattlesnake was 5 yards away from me, shuffled along and went in under a cactus. Oh, my God, was
oh my
I scared.
God. Oh, my God, yeah, this is a snake you thought was dead, turned out to be alive.
Yeah.
Riding about
and
in your buggy.
6 foot long, Stoney.
Well, yeah, snakes. I mean, they are, you know, they do have some length.
That was a scary moment.
Right.
My buggy went up the fairway about 300 mile an hour.
I was going to say, so you were just giving this lift to this snake around the golf course.
Oh, I can't deny I got in that buggy and shot off like you've never known.
I can well believe it, actually. Well, it's a desert golf course. It might well happen. You know, you've got to be prepared for these things.
Yeah, well, they warn you, Stoney, to be fair, before you go out, and there's a couple of par threes where you've got your tee, where you can sort of just walk through the bush and the cactuses and all that. But they advise you to walk on the buggy path and not walk through because of the rattlesnakes.
And the snakes are not allowed on the path? Is there like a big sign saying no rattlesnakes on this path? So they know, and then if you walk on the path, you're safe. Is that what
it is?
Yes,
that's correct.
Yeah. No, do you feel like I'm not taking this story seriously enough? Is that your... Yes, Tony, that's what it is.
This is why it's called the comedy breakfast. Because of your great skills.
Bless you. Harry Maguire. I want to talk about Harry Maguire. With one of the headlines we didn't have, Harry Maguire possibly going to Manchester City for £65 million. I mean, there's another story this morning with the transfer stuff about Wan-Bissaka. Looks like that might be a done deal going to Manchester United for £60 million. Now, I don't really understand why is Harry Maguire only worth £5 million more than Aaron Wan-Bissaka? Harry Maguire, of course, been to a World Cup, you know, a league, not a title winner, actually. No, he isn't. But, you know, a quality player, experience and all the rest of it. Wan-Bissaka, he's had one good season.
Well, we both saw Wan-Bissaka play for Crystal Palace at Arsenal right near the end of the season. And with your scouting report, you'd have to say that defensively and with the pace that he's got, he is a very, very good defender. I'm not sure, Stoney, if he's got the quality going forward in the final third that a top, top team would need. The way the teams play now with their fullbacks going so high.
Trent Alexander-Arnold?
Yes.
He ain't him?
No. And I'm not... I think Walker's improved at Man City over time. His quality has got a lot much, much better than what
Trippier
it was.
Trippier had a good season the season before last.
Yeah.
You know, before the World Cup, and he looked great at the World Cup, didn't he?
Yeah.
You know, I'd have picked him.
But the thing is with Manchester United at the moment, they are going to have to pay over the odds
That's
to get players
right.
into the building because they're not in the Champions League. All the players at that level want to play in the Champions League. Nearly all the players want to play the Man City style of football, and that is where I would say that Harry Maguire would probably be thinking, I want to play for Pep Guardiola in the Champions League rather than Ole Gunnar Solskjaer at Manchester United, who are challenging just to get into the Premier League places.
Yeah, and I suppose it's also about, would you rather play next to Emerick Laporte or Chris Smalling, say? You know, and I'm not having a go at Chris Smalling or Phil Jones or whatever. I don't think any of the United centre-halves are anywhere close to as good as Laporte. So I guess as a defender, there's that option as well, plus the players ahead of you. as well.
Manchester United have got a total rebuild, haven't they?
Yeah, it does look that way.
It seems that De Gea wants to go. He's got a year to go on his contract. And if he runs that down, that is going to cost Manchester United so much money. Pogba's now come out while I've been away on holiday and said that it could be probably time for a good move now.
Yeah.
Which is in the middle. He should have done that right at the end of the season. So that would have annoyed everybody at Man United in the hierarchy. You know, if he wanted to leave, he should have gone in and seen him at the end of the season and said, listen, I've had enough. I want to get out. Let me go. To let it dwell and hang on and let a month go by, for me, is ridiculous.
But like you say, complete rebuild, and maybe that's what it is. It's not that Wan-Bissaka is essentially worth the same as Harry Maguire. It's the fact that Man United are going to have to pay a premium just purely because everyone knows how badly they need players.
And how poor their recruitment has been over the last few years. It's clearly been nowhere near where they need to be. You know, we've watched Manchester United over the years, Stoney, and they've always had the best centre-forwards, the best central midfield players, the best centre-backs, the best goalkeeper, and now they haven't. And they are falling into the gap where they're going to be finding it very, very difficult next season if they don't pay over the odds to get these players.
This is Love Sport.
The details are Gary Monk was sacked by Birmingham this week after a dispute with the club. The Birmingham CEO claimed the dispute was over the use of Monk's agent. Jiandong Ren says relationship disintegrated when he told Monk he can no longer use his agent James Featherstone in all the club's transfer deals. This is a murky area at best, isn't it, Martin? This sort of stuff goes on. They obviously have people that they like to work with, managers and what have you. And I guess the Birmingham CEO did not like that and would not allow that to happen. And that's how the relationship broke down.
I can see your point there, Stoney, of what's been put out there. But just a few days ago, I read somewhere that Birmingham City had signed Gardner.
Right.
And sold a player to Aston Villa.
Okay.
For $6 million, which manager never agreed with.
No. Jota.
So he went for $6 million from Birmingham to Aston Villa. Obviously, the manager wouldn't be happy with that. But then exchange, Gardner went back to Birmingham.
Okay.
The manager said he didn't want Gardner.
Yeah.
The owner said, we're having him. So what does the manager do?
Yeah.
Does he say, I'll keep my job and I'll just go along with what the owner wants and play players that I don't think are good enough for what I need? So that is a real dilemma.
Because in the end, as a manager, if you've got people being bought over your head and bought in, what if they're not good enough? If you don't play them, does the owner have a go at you for that? If you do play them, does it affect the team? I mean, it's not ideal, is it?
It is not ideal. So a lot has been made about this agent and supposed best friend doing all the deals. But all the deals would have had to be signed off anyway by the CEO of Birmingham City. The agent Gary Monk can't just sit in their office and bring wheel players in and sign them and do all deals just through Monk and the agent in Gary Monk's office in Birmingham. It all has to be written off and signed off by the club secretary and also by the chief exec, who probably at that money level would have to get it checked off with the owner.
What about what Ren said? Look, he said, look, I've got the football club to look after, and if you let one agent control all transfers, it's very dangerous. That is what he said. Now, what do you think of that statement? Because it does strike me, you don't really want just one agent dealing with all the transfers. It's a little bit, none shall come to the Lord except through me, you know?
Yes, I can see what you're saying, Stoney. But the fact of the matter is, his agent may have been contacting the players to bring them in, but all of the deals have to be signed off by the chief exec and the club secretary. They can't sit in their own office and ignore the chief exec and the club secretary. It has to be signed off.
It's not so much about signing off, because in the end, if Gary Monk says, I want to buy this player, this player, this player and this player, right?
Yeah.
I need four players. If they're all being handled by the same agent, is that in itself an issue? That's what I'm asking.
It could be, but the chief exec has the right to sit across the desk and say, well, who is that player's agent? Before Gary Monk's agent goes in and says, right, I'm doing the deal. Basically saying, I'm overtaking the player's agent,
yeah,
and replacing him, because that is what happens at certain levels. That is what happens. The clubs use one agent and he just goes over the top of the player's agent and says, right, you're coming here, and the player's agent then gets a smaller cut than what he would normally take out of the deal.
All right, or the club pay through the nose and they're paying two agents. That's the other possibility, I guess, as well.
No,
I mean,
it doesn't work like that.
Doesn't work.
No, it'll go through one agent and he cuts the other one in.
Right, well, now what's happened is, because of what's happened at Middlesbrough are investigating transfers they've done because they're wondering if they've paid out. I suppose the implication is that the clubs have had to pay out for an extra agent, which is basically Gary Monk's mate, right?
Yeah.
That's what they're investigating. It doesn't mean that's what's been going on. As you said, the player's agent will take a lower fee.
But Stoney, why would Middlesbrough not already know who's done all the deals, how much has been paid out, where all that money's gone? It's a click of a button. When you say it's being investigated, it sounds like he's got the FBI looking into it.
Well,
it's a simple transaction. Everything has to be recorded for the with the FA. Everything has to be sanctioned with the Football League. It's not that difficult to see who's done the deals and who hasn't done the deals. And investigating, I think the word would be looking at, just to check.
While there is no suggestion, I've read it here, while there is no suggestion of any wrongdoing on the part of Monk or Featherstone, who is the agent, a senior Borough insider has said their relationship was one of the key reasons behind the former Swansea boss's sacking in December 17. So obviously they weren't particularly happy with the way things go. So when it... you know, if I'm an owner of a football club and I've got my manager and I want to buy Paul Pogba, we have to go through Minoraiola, right? You cannot get to Pogba without going through his agent.
Yeah.
What if I've got my mate who wants to be involved in that deal as well? I'm helping him set up as an agent. I said, listen, I'm manager of this club. You can be the agent who deals with all the deals. And now I want you to go and get Paul Pogba. Well, I'm not sure that Pogba's agent is going to be taking a smaller cut just to accommodate my mate. Why should he?
They don't need to. But they turn around and say, well, you're not having my player then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I suppose it's as simple as that, isn't it, really? I mean, we don't know the full details. Wren has told Sportsmail, this is the... owner of Birmingham City, that his relationship disintegrated with Monk when he told him he could not use Featherstone in all the club's transfer deals. He was involved in 9 of the 18 deals conducted by Birmingham after Monk arrived at the club in March 2018. I mean, to a certain extent, as a manager, it's probably easier just dealing with one person, isn't it?
Of course it is. As a manager, you get 20 calls a day, every one of them telling you how good his player is. At that level, I've got a fantastic player playing in Division 1 in France. You need to see him. He's the next N'Golo Kanté. You need to get over and see him. It's non-stop, non-stop, non-stop. And managers don't need it. They don't want it. Why has it taken Birmingham City so long to sack Gary Monk? If they didn't want him there, he should have got rid of him at the end of the season to give the new people, the new person, the chance to move in and get going. He had a very good relationship with the players. He had a very good relationship with the supporters. For the first time in a long, long time, it seemed that Birmingham City was gathering a bit of pace, and now it's been deflated. Difficult time for them.
Points deducted last year as well, weren't they? Let's have a chat. Paris is coming. Good morning, Paris.
Good morning, Ian. Good morning, Martin. How are we?
Yeah, doing all right. Thank you very much. We are fine, thank you. We're just looking at highlights of Royal Ascot. Frankie Dettori won 4 races yesterday.
4 races. The first 4 races of the day, all with Frankie Dettori riding the horse. A fantastic display from him. Kicked it off with a winning streak by guiding Ali. So that's Ali to a narrow victory from the Ventura Rebel in the Norfolk Stakes.
I think it's probably a bit like the Mo Salah sort of Ali. It's that sort of sound.
Well,
right?
I'll
it's the Arabic.
Sound like you've got something in your throat.
I know that is the Arabic thing going on. Ali, right? Anyway,
so you started the day off with that. Good start. Great. Won a race. Marvellous. Then got on into the second race. Second win of the day in the Hampton Court Stakes with Sangarius. You know, again, you're going, okay, 2 in a row. Not bad, not bad. Then 3 in a row. completed a hat-trick on Gosden's 4-1 prize Star Catcher in the Ribblesdale Stakes. I do quite like the names of some of these stakes, Ribblesdale.
Did you back any of these horses, Paris?
I don't bet, Martin. I don't bet. I don't gamble. No.
All right, then.
But anyway.
That's killed that one.
Stone dead. Anyway, so does all that. And then, of course, the big race of the day, Gold Cup on Ladies' Day, wins on the favourite Stradivarius. A second successive Gold Cup victory for both him and the horse.
Yeah.
So, you know, quite a partnership they've got there. You know, Dottori, he's 48 years old now.
He's at the edge of what, how far he can keep going. I mean, we spoke to Will Haley yesterday, a racing correspondent, and I was asking him about this. But he's fit and he's still up for it. And he said the point is he wouldn't get the rides if he wasn't as good as anyone else. So that's why he's getting them. And his age really has nothing to do with it. He can't be going on for another 15 years.
Is he riding again today?
I'd expect him to be riding again.
Or will
today.
He wake up this morning and getting out of bed and go, oh, aches and pains. My back's a bit stiff.
We all get that. But you know what? He's doing very, very well. He won 4 yesterday. I imagine people were thinking he might have won all 6 or 7 or however many he was running in. But he got beaten in the 5th by not by much, apparently.
No, not by much. Of course, you know, he did, 1996, he won all 7.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's...
Not a Royal Ascot, this was. This wasn't a Royal Ascot, was it? I'm not sure. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it was.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he has done it at Royal Ascot before.
Right.
You know, and of course, he won his first Gold Cup in 1992.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, we're saying 48. He's still up for it. Obviously, he's still getting the rides. But at some point, you've got to go, Frankie, it's quite a high-intensity sport. Like, if you fall off that horse, you get injured quickly.
They just showed a picture of him being interviewed a couple of minutes ago. He looked unbelievably happy to be there. He doesn't want to stop. Why would he want to stop? Lester Piggott went to, 60 or something, didn't he? I think they jockeys can go on a little bit. And also, you know, 50 is the new 40 now and all that.
Is that what people have been telling
you? That's the new 40?
That's what people who are 50 say. That's what they say. So, you know what? Fair play to him. I'm sure the bookies were a little bit worried when he won 4 in a row because they're thinking, this could really hurt us, because there are people, plenty of people who would
follow
bet on him
jockey.
Winning. Follow the jockey, of course. Yeah. And he's got a good trainer as well. So, you know what? Fair play to Frankie Dottori for yesterday. More Royal Ascot today.
More
How's
Royal
the weather?
Today?
What are the trains like? You can tell us later.
Yeah, never good with the trains. Don't hold your hopes up for South Western Railway. Another person who's, you know, come back from injury, great comeback, superstar of the sport, Andy Murray.
Yes.
Returned to tennis at Queen's yesterday, playing doubles with Feliciano, or Deliciano if you're Judy Murray. Lopez.
She really likes him. She quite fancies Deliciano Lopez.
Quite likes the look of the tall 37-year-old Spaniard.
I mean, it's sort of, imagine you're playing tennis and your doubles partner and your mum is getting quite, hot under the collar with your doubles partner.
Just
and you're
imagine
going,
it.
Mother, please. Can I come and watch you practice again? No, mother, you can't. It must be a bit odd. But anyway, they're doing very well.
Doing
I'm hoping
well.
He gets to the final, because I've got tickets to the final on Sunday.
Invested interest.
Going to Queens. Hoping to see Delpo, but he got injured.
But your son's a good player, isn't he?
Yeah, my son can play, yeah. My son's a good player. Yeah, but not to any sort of level. He just runs me around the court when we play now. I just chug about. It's meant to be exercise for him. He just runs me from side to side of the court.
Well,
you're right, Dad.
Brilliant on Sunday, wasn't it?
Hopefully Murray will be in the final. But they beat the favourites yesterday.
Beat the favourites yesterday. Convincingly, 2 sets.
Yeah.
I mean, well, 7-6, 6-4. Mm. And, you know, of course, all the people, eyes on Murray. There's one point where a shot comes in and he dives for it, ends up on the floor, and you can see the crowd go, Ooh,
mind the hip, Andy.
And he's on the floor.
It's like an old person having a fall.
Exactly. He's had a fall, but the thing is, and he felt directly on the hip.
Yeah.
Got up and like, okay.
Yeah.
And
his hip is fixed. He said after the game, I had no pain whatsoever. We heard the interview. He's doing very well. It's great. Can he come back to the level he has been at? Well, time will tell. But you know what? Stan Wawrinka came back from 2 knee operations. Djokovic has had back stuff. Federer has come back. Maybe he can.
Maybe
wouldn't
he can.
That be something? I mean, Andy Murray coming back next year, winning Wimbledon.
Well, I was just trying to visualise with Andy laid on the floor injured, his mum would have been sat in the stand looking at his partner.
Yeah, not even paying attention.
I wonder if she even knew that Andy's
Mum,
got injured.
Mum! Sorry, Andy, I'm busy right now. Feliciano's changing his shirt between sets.
Yes. I'm Deliciano, come and talk to me.
Deliciano, I can help you with your double.
Baby. Get up.
So Andy Murray is laying on the floor injured, and neither his mother nor his doubles partner are paying attention. In fact, his double partner is taking his shirt off.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I'm on board with this.
Me neither, but we know. Martin started it. Ask him where it goes from here.
No, we'll leave that one to everyone's imagination.
Okay. Leave it to everyone's imagination. Okay. So Andy's back. Of course, only player that's had something similar to what he's had is one of the Bryan brothers, who, of course, only plays doubles.
Yes.
He might play singles in his private life, whatever, but doubles on the circuit. So it can be done for a doubles player. The suggestion is the intensity of the singles tour, which, you know, best of five and, you know, by yourself, you're covering more of the court.
Singles, closing the title.
Completely different game, Paris, isn't it? Completely different. Over five sets.
I've said the same thing. You know, it's a different game, but I don't know if he's going to be at that level. And is he a person that you think you can see coming back and going, okay, I'm all right being number 30 in the world, number 40, and just kind of going in the second round?
You know what I think? I think the guy has got tremendous amounts of self-resolve and determination. And just to get to the point where he's won three Grand Slams while Nadal and Federer and Djokovic are playing, and Wawrinka and Delpo and Cilic and all the rest of these brilliant players, and he's in there. So the guy is unbelievably determined. Whether he can get back to the level, we don't know. He's 31 now as well, isn't he? But you know what? Fair play to him. He's in a good place, and obviously, and he's diving about on his hip, and he's not hurting at all. He might not do that on hard courts.
For me, you're probably more blessed with tennis skills than myself, but I think with the ability that he's got, he's maximised every bit of skill that he's possibly got in his body to make himself as good as possible. Some of the others, I think, have been better players.
This is Love Sport.
The big debate this morning, on the back of Jesse Lingard's rather unfortunate Snapchat post, when him and his mates are in a rather lovely suite of hotel rooms in Miami, and they're just messing about. There's a bit of swearing, there's certain bad language, it's like sex simulation. In the end, they're young lads having a bit of fun, but obviously it doesn't look good. We wanted to ask the question about whether sports people have more responsibility now because of the rise of social media. Now, Martin, you said earlier, and I think you were very eloquent when you said it, about how footballers and sports people have to take responsibility now, but particularly if they're going to film it and put it out on social media.
Yeah, well, I think, Stoney, no one can begrudge the fact that they've got enough money to fly to Miami, stay in what looks like on the video footage a fantastic hotel. Mm. Looks like a 3 or 4 bedroom suite, which is going to
cost a lot of rooms, isn't it?
Thousands of pounds per night.
Yeah, and Jesse's paid for more to go out there. This is Jesse Lingard.
Say they've gone first class, they've got the best hotel, they've got the best suite, he's got his mates out with him, and so they should all go out and have a good time if he's got the money. No one can begrudge that. If they've got girls and they're out and about drinking and having a party time, then I don't think anyone can really begrudge that either at this time of year. No one can say no to that. But the fact that they've allowed that to be videoed and put out there, I'm sure they must have had a little sit down between themselves to say, we'll go out, we'll have a great time, we'll make sure we're respectful to everyone we meet, we'll have a great time, we'll go partying and go drinking and have a great time, but it's got to stay private.
I mean, he's 26 years old, right? I mean, I said he's a kid, and I sort of believe he is a kid emotionally.
I
think he probably is, because I think a lot of footballers, and you can tell me this, you know, everything's done for you, you're pampered and all the rest of it. And at 26, you've been playing professional football since you were 16, 17. It's very possible you haven't grown up, really. That's what I mean by a kid. He's a 26-year-old man, right? That's the truth of it. But
he's young at heart. There's no doubt about that. He's got a cheeky smile. He's got a cheeky grin. He's got a sense of humour. He's got loads of mates that are going to be going out at weekends. He's not in a settled relationship with three children. So he is going to be a little bit like that. But Stoney is
emotionally lacking in intelligence. That's the point I'm making.
Probably, yeah.
Probably, yes.
Well, I'm not sure he would know about Boris Johnson and stuff like what we've been talking about. And I'm sure he ain't really that bothered. But what he does know is that the brand of Manchester United, and I'm sure Ole Gunnar Solskjaer warned all of his players before they left their training ground for the very last time, you have a responsibility throughout the summer, whilst you're away from the training ground, You still play for Manchester United. You have a responsibility to the football club to make sure you go on a good holiday, you keep yourself fit, and there's nothing detrimental to yourself or to the football club that's going to go on any social media or any platform that's out there. And then his Solskjaer's now got this, and he's also got that Pogba bloke over in the Far East saying it's probably a good time to get a move. So he would be extremely unhappy, very, very disappointed in both his players.
The question then is, if you're on this sort of ridiculous money that they're earning, do they have an extra responsibility to behave even better, or, like you say, at the very least, to not film any shenanigans they get up to? Well, I mean, maybe that's what it's about.
They do have a responsibility. They do. I mean,
did you feel that responsibility as a footballer, though, Martin? I know it's a different time, but did you feel that responsibility?
Yeah, did you think it's yourself... not like it is now, Stoney?
No,
it's
but
not
I'm
like
asking
it
you.
With social media and cameras and Snapchat and all these other things that are out there now. It's Twitter. It's out there within seconds, so you cannot do it. And the amount of money that they earn, you cannot do it. You have a responsibility as a top Premier League club. The brand is global. They're working so hard to make their football clubs global brands. You cannot have employees getting involved in videos like that. And then a star player, your most expensive player, over the Far East saying that it's time for a move.
Yeah, no. I think there are two separate things here. I think there's bad behaviour, and then I think there's people who are going, I've had enough of being at this club. And
Stoney, that's dreadful behaviour.
Oh, I'm not saying it isn't bad behaviour, but I'm saying in terms of the way that they set an example for a team. I mean, we were talking about the fact that Israel Folau, the Australian rugby player, posted those awful posts about how homosexuals burn in hell and stuff like that. And he was rightly sacked. He was rightly sacked for saying something like that. But essentially what we're saying is, if you're an athlete and you're well known and people, you know, they'll see you in the street, oh, that's him over there who plays for them. You have a responsibility. You basically should keep your head down. You should keep your head down. Paul Scholes, the ultimate one in that sense, you know, he'd go home to his family, but he had a family. It's a bit different when you're single and you want to go out and have fun with your mates. Paul Scholes never seemed like that guy. He was 19. He went back home to his missus and his kids, and he seemed happy there. Not everyone is built like that.
No, they're not built like that, but you do have a responsibility. We've seen Ben Stokes, who's a fantastic player, and I really kind of like his character, and Hales
getting into trouble
down in
a nightclub.
Outside a nightclub, yeah. 2 o'clock in the morning.
What are
fighting.
You doing there? What are you doing there?
You shouldn't even be there.
No.
You shouldn't even be in that situation.
If you're their manager, you're telling them that. That is, you just cannot put yourself in that situation. Who got involved in a bit of trouble in a bar on a Friday night? I think it was in Wales a few weeks ago. We had a story like this. There are a number of stories like this. Personally, I'm amazed we don't hear more.
On the cricket stuff, Stoney, sorry, you've also got Hales, who's been involved with that Stokes incident, who twice has been done. Twice. Played for England. He's been done for social cocaine use or something.
It was drug use. I'm not quite sure whether it was cocaine or whatever. But yeah.
So what is he doing? What is he thinking of? Why is he even going anywhere near it? I am so happy that when Roy got injured, they said publicly, the selectors and Owen Morgan, that they'd have to think seriously about whether or not to bring Hales back in with the injury.
Which tells you that the rest of the team understand their responsibilities and you can't be behaving like that. So what we're saying is basically they have to be made to understand that at this level, with the social media that they have and the money they're earning, they have to behave themselves.
And I don't think Gareth Southgate will be very impressed
with Jesse Lingard. No.
Because the way that he's got this young group of men playing for our country so fantastically well, I don't think that Gareth Southgate would want that kind of person or player involved with his squad. I think he'll probably give him a warning. Say, so last time, Jesse, if you're going to represent your country, we have got to be whiter than white. We've got to be absolutely 100% committed, and if you want a night out with your mates, you get a private bar, you get a private place, no social media, and if anything comes out, I don't care who you are, you're not in my plans.
Well, if that doesn't wake him up, I don't think what will, because if you don't want to be involved with the England team at the moment, you're crazy. That was the big debate. Tell us what you think. Do you think athletes should be held to a higher level of responsibility because of the money they're earning and the role model part of their lives?
Love sport.
Paris has entered the room. He's got some stories from the front pages, I believe, Paris. Is that right?
I do. Oh, yes. Okay. Oh. Prepare for the stories from the front pages.
Oh, we are prepared. Give us them, Paris. Go on.
Headline for you. I love you, but a bigger bank balance is better.
You're saying that to me, or are you actually reading a headline?
I'm reading a headline.
Okay, fair enough.
disguising my true feelings for a headline. Having savings is more joyful than being happily married, a survey has found.
People get more happiness from having savings than being happily married. What a load of nonsense. That's nonsense, isn't it?
Who said that, Paris?
Who said... Yeah,
in the Metro today. And just, you know, they basically said a 10% boost to monthly savings has a more positive effect than a happy marriage, the Centre for Economics and Business Research found.
Oh, really? As opposed to the Centre for Happiness in Marriage found?
Yes.
What a load of... I mean, you know what? The thing is, I did management theory when I was an engineer years ago. And they said...
Were you an engineer?
I was an engineer, yeah.
I thought you were a comedian.
Yeah, before I was a comedian, I was an engineer. I was a very funny engineer. Now what I do when I'm... Because in the first couple of years of doing comedy, I used to fix stuff on the stage. If something wasn't working out, I used to screw in a few things. Did that? You're looking at me like...
Blimey, I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah. Quite handy. Anyway, what were we saying? Oh, yeah. I was saying that I did management theory when I studied engineering. Money does not make you happy. But money, if you're given more money, it will make you less unhappy. And there is a subtle difference. There is. But so I can't quite understand why they say that it actually makes you happier than a happy marriage. It makes no sense to me.
Mm. Well, okay. That's what it says. Also, the poll found that the happiest person in the UK, would you want to have a guess? What kind of person would be the happiest person in
what
the UK?
What kind of person?
So kind of like a, if you're giving them a profile, so like where they live.
Richard Branson.
What age? Well, I mean, Richard Branson probably is pretty happy. I mean,
I imagine he's quite happy.
Well,
yeah.
Why? What all the stress of all those planes, all those virgins flying, all airplanes flying all over the place? Why would that make him happy?
Maybe that wouldn't make him happy.
He might be waking up at 3:30 in the morning thinking, what am I going to do? That flight's not full up.
The happiest person I knew was a guy who was a cleaner, basically, and he just had a very happy demeanour about him. What is the profile of the happiest
profile
person?
Profile is someone under the age of 35 in Northern Ireland saving 10% of their income a month.
Right.
Apparently
okay.
So.
Okay. All right.
No, not okay. Anyway,
well,
moving on.
It's hard to sort of comment on that. Just go, okay, can we find someone who's from Northern Ireland
under
35 who's saving? Just we can talk to them and find out the secret?
Maybe next week. Okay. Maybe next week. But anyway, the highest life satisfaction was actually in the southwest of England, believe it or not, while the lowest was in London.
The lowest life satisfaction? Yeah, because everyone's chasing very hard.
The rat race.
It's the rat race. It's all that. It's the way you said it as well. The rat race. Yeah, through gritted teeth. Yeah. There is a bit of that. Yeah.
Bit of that.
Are you happy, Paris?
That's a very personal question to ask. What time is it? 8:40. We'll move on. Anyway, children expect rise of the robot.
That's a no then, isn't it? Go on.
He's rejected that quick.
He did. He pushed me right back.
No comment is what
happened.
That there.
Really is the actions of a very unhappy person. What have you got, Paris?
Children expect rise of the robot teachers. Nearly half of British children expect their teachers to be robots within the next 50 years, a study finds.
Right. Is that right?
Yeah, 3/4 of those aged 8 to 16 also believe every home will have robot helpers, while a fifth think Brits will be enjoying holidays in space.
We have robot helpers now. We have Alexa. That's a robot helper, isn't it?
My wife's got me.
Yes, okay. And
do this, do that. Do this, do that.
Yeah, but at some point you're not going to be able to, and they're going to get a robot who's going to come in and help.
Well, I'm a robot now.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Clean the car. Cut the grass.
Okay.
Hoover.
Yeah, the domestic chores is what you're saying. I think this is not a surprise.
Not
I'm
a surprise.
That more kids don't think this will happen sooner. We were talking about AI yesterday, weren't we?
Yeah, we were talking. Lots of people were scared about AIs yesterday.
I think they're
AIs,
crazy.
What are they?
Artificial intelligence.
So, you know, like 2001 A Space Odyssey. Open the pod bay doors, Hal. Like things going wrong. Terminator was an AI. Anyway, we'll move on.
look, it's the future and there's nothing we can do about it.
So they believe that. However, only 1/4 of them believe cities with clean air will exist in 50 years' time. So they're more confident about us getting robots in schools than us cleaning up the environment.
Yes, apparently every child in London breathes air which has particles which is are unsafe. I mean, every child. It's not a great place. But there's worse cities. In India, they're having terrible trouble. In Delhi, in Mumbai, really serious pollution problems. China as well.
I was in Mumbai a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And there's a permanent fog and it's pretty low.
Yeah, it's getting much worse. And the thing is,
I
went to India. First time I went to India in 1991. It wasn't like that, but they didn't have the cars.
Now
everyone's got cars and they don't have the pollution safeguards in place. It is a problem.
Is it getting better in our country, Paris?
Well, they're trying to take steps to make it better. I mean, the Mayor of London is having a day where there'll be no cars allowed into London at all in September.
Really?
No cars.
Great.
Nothing.
Do you know what?
What will happen? There'll be a train strike.
Well, that's a possibility. But you know what was interesting? When they had the climate change protests and all the bridges were blocked and there were no cars knocking about, it was actually quite nice. It really was. I'm not saying that it wasn't massively inconvenient for a lot of people, but just walking around London without the cars driving about, I thought it was really nice.
How am I going to get here?
Well, obviously, I understand there are issues, you know, but I'm just saying, just to see how it was. We got the ULEZ coming in as well, the ultra low emission zone. It's already here now, but it's going to be for a wider
ULEZ.
Yeah, ultra low emission zone. An acronym for the ultra low emission zone.
Who
and
knows?
That's yes, it's coming in.
That's your engineer talking, isn't it? Yeah,
no,
I'm
it's
an
just
engineer.
The acronym that they're using. I think it's a good thing that they ban cars as much or make it more difficult for cars or more expensive because the air's not good. I've got to think of the kids, Martin.
Yeah, but you're taking money out of Martin's pocket.
I'm not taking money, I think you should come in anyway. Just, you know, cycling.
I think we discussed this a few weeks ago when we were talking about the land. In America, I think it was down in South Carolina, one of the states down there, how much land is being taken over by water.
Three football pitches a day.
A day,
yeah.
And we were really shocked and surprised. And so I think most people now, Paris, are taking more of an interest in it, like with plastic and all that sort of stuff. And
well, that woman who was forcibly removed by Mark Field, the Foreign Office Minister yesterday, was a climate change protester. These things are going to happen more and more.
Well, it was quite interesting, because, of course, that big event, also there was a big event at British Museum as well, a kind of a dinner for a petroleum firm, and Greenpeace just went, well, hang on, why are we inviting these people into these big events? Why are we having big events for petroleum companies? And I suppose the answer is, we would like to still keep them sweet while changing the environment. Is there any middle ground?
Yeah, well, like, you know, hang on, we can't get away from the fact that we still drive cars and most plastic products use some sort of petroleum sort of based product to help make them, I believe. So it's, you know, we can't just go, we're not using your product anymore unless we find some sort of alternative.
It's going to take time as well, isn't it, Stoney?
It is going to take time. But it is a bit of a race between the climate and us getting off our addiction to cars and to...
Well, we had it the other week, didn't we? Just around the corner, all those people were sleeping on the bridge, weren't they?
They were. They were.
There's
and
a
it
tree
caused
on the bridge.
Massive disruption
didn't
to
it
everyone. But as my mother said, and I've said this to you, I said about the climate change protesters, and she went, at least the weather was nice for them. And I'm like, that's the point, Mum. That's why they're there. What else have you got? Give us one more.
Anyway, a story for you. School has asked pupils to vote for best-looking classmate. Teachers have been handed an F by parents after asking year 9 pupils to vote for their best-looking classmate
13-year-olds.
In the end-of-year awards.
Oh, they should do worst-looking as well, if we're going to do that. And yes, him, hideous bloke over there. Make him stand on the table. We're going to all look at him. And get him on one of those circular plates. You know, like in Chinese restaurants where the plate goes round.
Lazy
Susan. Stick him on the top, and you just circulate it and everyone just points at him and goes, ugly. And that'll make him feel good about himself, won't it? Or if it's a girl, it's even worse. Yeah, I mean, how can they do this?
That's
best looking class, mate. That's
how
wrong.
Are they allowed to do that?
Categories including best looking boy, best looking girl, best couple, and biggest
couple. They're 13
and
biggest what?
Biggest ego.
Oh, thank
which
God for that.
Have been revealed as part of celebrations at the end of term next month.
Oh dear,
they can't get away with that.
They've misjudged that. Unless I can be a judge, in which case I'm happy to get involved.
I think a few of the parents are not going to be happy with that, Paris.
No, the parents have are not particularly happy because they've had to pull the plug after mums and dads complained the contest would reinforce the belief that looks were more important than positive character traits.
I imagine the parents of the ugly kids were particularly upset about all this, right? Because the good-looking kids, the parents would go, yeah, I think that's an excellent idea. I'm happy for my son or daughter to enter that. But the ugly ones, I mean, as a child who didn't look all that good at school, I mean, this, by the way, you're looking at what you're looking at now, 56-year-old me, is the best it's ever been, all right?
Is it?
I grew up, yeah. Yes, it is, Martin. Yes, this never worked for me as an 18-year-old, all right? This is why I'm on the radio, even now. This didn't work at 18, but at 56, I've sort of settled into my face a little bit. A little bit. But at school, if there had been some sort of beauty contest at school, that is... Who thought that was a good idea?
Where would you finish in your class?
I would have finished... I would have been demoted a year. That's how bad I looked. I would have been in the relegation zone for the entire season. I think that's a bit unfortunate. Were you a good-looking kid, Martin? You a good-looking kid?
No.
Paris, were you a good-looking kid?
I was basically, as for listeners at home, very wide as I am now.
Paris is quite
wide. Kind of rotund. Yeah.
I'm going to take you up on that, Paris, because I've been away for a couple of weeks. You have lost a lot of weight.
Thank you, Martin.
You're looking good. Lost a lot of weight. You wouldn't be in the relegation zone now if we did a beauty contest in
just outside it.
Of these four people.
Just outside it. Yeah, no, I mean, he'd still be, you know, struggling.
You have lost a lot of weight, haven't you?
I'm needing a transfer, is what you're saying, to boost me up the table.
Well, you've been eating healthy because I've seen your lunch
boxes.
My lunch boxes,
yeah.
You've lost a lot of weight, haven't you?
I don't know. I haven't.
You've got to admit.
Anyway. I haven't weighed myself. I haven't checked my mass. This is a terrible misjudged idea
that I cannot believe they were allowed to even think this was a good idea.
Yeah. So Hugh Christie School in Tonbridge, Kent, have had to change their ideas about what their end of term awards will be.
How about that teacher that came up with those ideas is.
Yeah, I mean,
why? This morning.
I mean, kids, especially at that age, at 13, 12, 13, they're vulnerable, right? They are. Everyone's feeling a little bit self-conscious about themselves. And, well, self-conscious is about yourself, obviously. And everyone's feeling a bit self-conscious. And then suddenly you're having a beauty contest. Judged by who, by the way? By the other children or the teachers?
I think it's to judge by their classmates. And, you know, teenagers can be mean, but I mean, even then, like being told, you know, I mean, admittedly, we're not going, okay, you're ugly. It's you're picking one person in the class. I'm not defending this. I'd like to clarify that I'm not defending this competition.
They're not ranking the one to 30.
It's not like a, you know, a countdown, like a Top of the Pop style. Let's start at 50 and work our way down.
This is Love Sport.
Now, the Premier League will not use video assistant referees in 2019-20 to rule on goalkeepers moving off their line to save a penalty. This comes after Scotland were denied a last 16 World Cup place after Lee Alexander, it was, saving Argentina's initial penalty and VAR ordered a retake. Joining us now is the former Premier League referee, Keith Hackett. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning.
Morning. Now, VAR, do you think VAR should be used for this? I mean, it is a rule that you're meant to stay on your line. But no goalkeeper in the history of goalkeeping, as far as I can tell, has ever stayed on their line.
I think you're absolutely right about the goalkeeper and goalkeeper movement. I think that what they're trying to do, the lawmakers, is almost chain the goalkeeper to the goalpost, but in using words rather than a chain. I think it's difficult for referees to make the call, and I think now we're getting into VAR and its use, which is giving us another game, frankly.
Yeah.
I mean... The lawmakers sit round the table, and Martin will tell you from history, I suffered badly by having on a Thursday to listen to the lawmakers changing the law on denial of an obvious goal-scoring opportunity and then having to apply it on the Sunday with no one knowing. Now, I think that what we've got here is we've got young women referees learning the game, trying to officiate, and VAR taking over. And my fear is that the people are sitting round a table, perhaps not listening to referees or even listening to players or ex-managers, whatever, so that we avoid these sort of levels of controversy.
Keith, do you think it's taken over or do you think it's adding to the game?
Well, I think that if VAR is going to apply in this case in Scotland, it applies the law correctly. Clearly, VAR's come in and it's correct. However, what VAR failed to recognise that there were defending players also entering the penalty area as that kick was being taken. And therefore, on that second goal, a retake should have been advised by the VAR, and the referee should have acted accordingly. And this, you know, we're concentrating on the goal line. You know, the law says that...
The players have got to be outside the box. But the players go inside the box all the time, don't they?
Yeah, same thing.
So
for the run-up.
How finite are we going to be here? You know? And then we've got offside, where we've got millimetres. And we're,
Yeah.
Hey,
Keith, can I ask you
another
one?
I know that we
want
the game to be right, but at the same time, I think we're getting into the technicalities of taking the game to a different level. And is that positive or negative?
Yeah, that's a good question. And Keith, there's another one that I'd like to ask you about. The Champions League final, the handball. Was that was that handball in your mind?
Well, if I in my refereeing career, I would never have given that as handball. However, given the laws and what they're now stating, and it's quite clear, first of all, you can no longer score a goal with a hand. Well, that's fine. But now we're talking about the silhouette and we're talking about the hands being wide. And it strikes me that the advice that the referees have got at the World Cup, and I suspect will have on a worldwide basis, is that they will now err that where a ball hits the hand or arm and it's slightly outstretched, they're going to give it. They're going to give the penalty kick. And we seem to have forgotten about the surprise element of distance. We seem to have forgotten about the hand movement towards the ball. And so I think next season with VAR in the Premier League, we're going to get controversy because referees are going to award penalty kicks when even referees disagree with what is the outcome.
Yeah, but Keith, the thing is, I mean, we had controversy. We had plenty of controversy before we had VAR. I remember when we were talking about this in the office yesterday. Before the World Cup, everyone was saying if they give a penalty every time somebody wrestles someone down in the box, it's going to be 10 penalties a game. That's not what happened. What happened was a couple of penalties were given and then people stopped the wrestling. They stopped all that and it was much better. So maybe what will happen is, in time, these things will become a little clearer as to what is and isn't a penalty and a foul, which is what we want, isn't it? It's more like a CCTV type camera watching you, so don't misbehave.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm a big supporter of VAR. Don't get me wrong. I've been positive from day one because I think referees need it. You know, when Mike Riley stated in the Premier League that one in every five major decisions referees are getting wrong, then clearly the referee needs help. And therefore, I'm for VAR. And I think what's got to happen is coaches and managers have got to spend time with the players now, and the players have got to understand the laws. And when a player, a defender, is challenging for the ball, he's got to now think about very carefully and retrain his brain to determine where he's going to put his hands and arms.
Yeah, I guess. And do you think, the refereeing stand at the Women's World Cup, I know that the Scotland boss, Shelley Kerr, was complaining about the appalling refereeing. But do you think that the lawmakers are making VAR unusable?
I think that the lawmakers, until we get things bedded in, I think that at the moment what the lawmakers are doing are changing too much all at once. You know, we've got handball, we've got managers now being cautioned or red carded. We've got substitutes that can go off where they like. We've got one where if the ball now hits the referee, it's a drop ball.
Yeah.
Just think about this one. It's a drop ball and it's the forward who's going to be taking the drop ball and he kicks straight into goal, right? We all think that's a goal. But in fact, the law is now saying it's got to be played by a second player. So if referees are not aware of these law changes and players and managers are not aware, on the day, there's going to be some surprises and they're all going to be looking at each other thinking, what's going off? So it's about training, it's about communication, it's about things like today. What we're doing right now is hopefully conditioning the public to say, look, I accept VAR for what it is in the hope that it is going to prevent players doing certain things, and it is going to get help referees to get the major decisions right. I mean, if I'd have had VAR when I had to dismiss Tony Gale, I think the VAR would have been saying to me, you got that wrong, Pete.
Martin, Martin never mentioned that this morning. He never even talked about that this morning.
Well, I mean, Martin and I and Tony have exchanged views. And the thing is that, I've got to apply the law.
Yeah.
But what I say is that the FA sprung on us, referees, the Thursday before that game, a change in interpretation. And I say it again, I've said it before, Tony Gale would not have even got a yellow card, you know, on the day before, if you like, or the week before. That is how it's so important that referees and players and managers and the public are educated in the nuances of these law changes and how they impact on the game.
We'll do the best. Go on.
Was right.
We'll do the best we can on this station. Yeah. Thank you, Keith, for clarifying things as we go along. It's Keith Hackett, former Premier League referee. By the way, you don't know what we're talking about. This was about a game that you played in, Martin.
Yeah. I've got a lot of respect for him, to be fair, Stoney, Keith Hackett. He was the referee in the FA Cup semi-final, played at Villa Park, West Ham versus Notts Forest. A boiling hot day on a Sunday, packed stadium, and he made an error. And we lost the game.
And it cost you the game, didn't it?
Sent off the centre-back, so we were down to 10 men. Like I said, boiling hot day. Forest popped it about and beat us. But then, just a couple of years ago, I was at a pre-season referees meeting, which they have with all the Football League managers, and it was at Wycombe Wanderers Football Club. And at the end of the meeting, you know, a couple of hours in the afternoon about the new rule changes and stuff, and he came round the back to find me. He tapped me on the shoulder and said, I've got to apologise for my decision that day. It was a wrong decision. And he said, it's nice to be able to see you and say it face to face. And from that day onwards, of course, it was a big disappointment losing the FA Cup semi-final. But I had a lot of respect for him, and I just thought it was a really manly thing to do. And I thought fair play to him, to be honest.
Good on him.
This is Love Sport.
Thanks for listening to the Ian Stone Comedy Breakfast Podcast Edition. I'm back every weekday morning, 6:30.